This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Jackie and Debbie, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Laura will read the preamble.
My name is Laura, and I'm an alcoholic. AA Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses or nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help the other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Patrick will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Patrick. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Patrick.
12 steps. Step 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step 2, came to believe that power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Becca will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Becca. I'm an alcoholic. All right. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for a group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as we may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of the meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Lucy.
Hi, I'm Lucy. I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me? Oh, good. I'm so glad that so many people made it here tonight. I was thinking about it on the way here, and, you know, part of me was saying, well, you know, is anyone even going to show up? Should I even go? And then I was thinking, you know, if it were a matter of me getting to the bar, I would walk 5 miles if I had to. You know, forget about a transit strike. So anyway, I'm glad to be here. I'd like to thank Melissa for asking me to speak. It's such an honor to be asked to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I've been reflecting on where I came from, and when I came to these rooms, I was a mess. I was a shell of a person. And I saw the light in all of your eyes, and I wanted what you had, but I really had no idea how that was going to happen. I didn't believe that I could have this thing, that I could be happy, joyous, and free. And I'm standing here today, and for the most part, I'm happy, joyous, and free most of the time. And I have a design for living, so when I run into problems, I have a solution, and I have people who can point me to the solution when I forget what the solution is. And I'm really grateful for that. So just a little bit about where I come from. You know, from a very early age, like many of you, I felt like I was different from everybody else. I thought there was something terribly wrong with me, and I didn't know how to do life, and I didn't get the manual that all the other kids got. I didn't get the same parents that they all got, and there was something wrong with me, and I was never going to do well. I was uncomfortable in my own skin, and when I discovered alcohol at age 11, that was the first time I really felt a sense of ease and comfort ever in my life. I believe I was born an alcoholic. I don't really care to debate that. It doesn't matter too much. I'm an alcoholic, you know, regardless of how I became an alcoholic. It doesn't matter. So when I first picked up alcohol, I knew that I was destined to drink. I saw it in my family, and I knew that it was something that I was going to do one day. And that day came when I was 11 years old. Things were not good in my family for me. I was really uncomfortable and didn't know how to manage any of my feelings, didn't have a relationship with a higher power. I felt like I was very much alone in the world. And when I picked up alcohol, I felt comfortable in my skin. I felt a false sense of courage. I felt like I was a part of life. And I started drinking regularly when I was about 13. And I thought it was normal because the other kids at school were doing it too. And we go to parties and we get wasted. And I thought it was normal. And looking back on it with a sponsor, when I did my first step, I realized that my reaction to alcohol was never normal. Normal people don't feel that they're destined to abuse alcohol. You know, and normal people don't have a couple of beers and end up taking off all their clothes in public. And that sort of thing would happen to me regularly. I don't really want to go into all the sordid details here at the podium, but suffice it to say that I acted very abnormally when I drank alcohol. And I got into a lot of trouble, and one of the things that happened to me was I started to get very, very depressed when I started drinking regularly. So when I wasn't drunk, I was in a state of just dark depression and feeling suicidal. And My parents thought, well, you should see a therapist and go on medication, and the therapist, you know, at a certain point said, well, you should really be hospitalized. And so I went to my first rehab when I was 14 for depression. And by the grace of God, my roommate there was an alcoholic, and she was going to AA meetings in the rehab. And I went with her just to check it out. And when I walked into this room and I heard the people telling their stories, for the first time in my life, I felt like, oh, these are my people. Like, they get what's going on with me. I don't know why. I don't think I'm an alcoholic, but this feels like a safe place. And I proceeded to go out and drink and do drugs and all sorts of other things for many years. And not many years, but many years after that. I was in rehab 3 times total. After the 3rd rehab, they said, thank you, you're an alcoholic and you cannot drink safely and you can't leave here unless you go to AA meetings every day. And the choice that I had before me was go to AA meetings every day or never go home and stay in a lockdown facility. And so I went to AA meetings every day and I had a great time. I loved Alcoholics Anonymous from the very beginning. I had a sponsor who I didn't work the steps with, but I would hang out with a lot. And I thought that was just great. And after 6 months away from a drink, I went on vacation, and I had this lurking notion that I could control my drinking like other people that I saw. And I decided that I would have a beer, and that I could have just one beer. And I did. I was at a pub, and I was out with people, and I had a beer, and that was it that night. And 4 months later, I was getting drunk and high every day. I got kicked out of my school, and I was sent to reform school. I was having violent arguments with my mother. My life was completely unmanageable, and it was all your fault. It had nothing to do with me. It was, you know, my parents' fault. It was the school's, you know, and the list goes on. So, anyway, just to fast forward a little bit, I kept drinking that way until I was 22. I managed to graduate from college. I have no idea how. I was drunk a lot of the time. I did have periods of controlled drinking where I would substitute with other addictions. But, you know, bottom line was that I was an alcoholic suffering from untreated alcoholism. So when I was 22, I was in another program, and my sponsor in that program was also sober in AA, and she suggested that I might have a problem with drinking. And I had really a moment of grace where I was willing to put down alcohol. Before, whenever people would try and 12-step me back into AA, I would say, you know, no, not for me, been there, done that, you know, I'm not an alcoholic. And for some reason, I was willing to listen to this woman when she suggested that I had a problem. And I put down alcohol, and I wish I could tell you that I came to meetings every day, got a sponsor, worked the steps, but I didn't do it that way. I did it my way, which was to move to Colorado, and I lost my job and moved to Colorado, and I had about 18 months dry, and I was really just on the verge of either committing suicide or picking up alcohol. You know, I had it in my head that, again, I could have one glass of wine. Or the other option was to get shoulder surgery so that I could get a morphine drip, because that sounded really, really good to me at that point. And again, by the grace of God, I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in this tiny little mountain town. There's a meeting every day there. And raised my hand and said, you know, I'm suffering from untreated alcoholism. I need help. And there was somebody there to help me. And she took me through the steps in the big book. And my life completely changed from the inside out. You know, the circumstances of my life didn't change right away, but I changed. My perception changed. And I really believe that I have a disease of perception here. My view of the world, left to my own devices, is completely off. So when I worked the steps, I had the spiritual awakening that they talk about in the big book, and I was told that I needed to carry the message to other alcoholics. So today, what I do to stay sober is I come to meetings to try and be of service to others. I call my sponsor every day. Actually, no. I call him every day that I remember to. And, you know, I try and be of service, you know, in all my affairs, not just in meetings, but at work. And I am living a life beyond my wildest dreams. I have an amazing job that I never, ever thought I could have. I'm engaged to a wonderful man. We're getting married in September. That's, like, beyond me. I can't even believe that that I'm able to do that, you know. I have wonderful women in my life who I get to sponsor and take through the steps and watch them grow and change and see the miracle happen before my eyes. It's an incredible gift. And I can't believe it, you know. I don't always feel so grateful, but I have people to remind me when I forget. And that's the important thing. You know, I don't have to be perfect. I'm not fixed or cured by any means, but I have these built-in reminders of what the solution is, and that's how I stay sober today. So if you're new, please grab somebody after the meeting, get a sponsor, and do the work, because your life could really just be amazing. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Fernando.
Hello, do you hear me? Well, I think I'm not going to make it today. But I'm here. I took three taxis, but I'm here. My name is Fernando, and I'm an alcoholic. My sponsor is Christian, and I'm from this group. I'm in my step four. My sobriety day is August 5th, 2005, and I born in Acapulco, Mexico, and I become for a big family. We are seven boys and seven girls. I'm the baby. It's really, really big family. I'm the baby. Actually, my father used to own a factory from hats. So they gave me a really good education, and I never miss. I mean, I have everything, and I knew from the beginning that I was too spoiled. So my big brothers, they used to bother me all the time, and I used to be crying. And they used to bother me with that thing that you're gonna be gay. So that hurt me so much. It used to bother me a lot. And I used to go and tell my parents what happened. So they used to punish them. And it was all the time that happened. I never drank, I never smoked, and I never do drugs until when I started 25. My father is an alcoholic, and my brothers are alcoholics. So I knew that it was a really bad disease. But one time when I went to this club, I wanted to be with someone who used to drink a lot, and my only way to be with a person, it was drinking. I started drink, I didn't like it. It was really nasty taste. But I drank the first beer, and I changed. I mean, I feel different. I can sing, I can talk, I can do anything I want. So I started drinking, and I love it. I was drinking every night that I used to go out. I used to go out like three nights a week, and I used to be very popular in the clubs and all that stuff. And I started drink, but one day of my life, something happened in my life. In shortly time, I guess it was like in a month, one of my brothers died. he was an alcoholic, and he died for an accident. Then my cousin, who used to live with me, he went to Mexico, and he died too, like 1 week and the other week. I started drinking. I was so depressed. I used to go out the same night that I was too depressed, and I drank. I went to the club, and I get back home, and somebody jumped me. He almost killed me. He took everything I have, and I was in the floor with a lot of blood and everything, and that didn't stop me. I was still drinking all the time. One day I went to the bathroom, and it was so dark, and I broke my leg. I didn't drink for 1 month. I was with the cast and everything, and I couldn't. I told them I'm never going to drink, but I went to a restaurant. I started drinking one beer, and then I get drunk, totally drunk. And my family used to tell me, you had a problem. But I never would admit that I was an alcoholic. And all this stuff, I started drinking every day. It was just one beer, 2 beers. But then I started drinking like 4, 5, 6 pack. It was so really bad. I remember last December, it was the 21st, and everybody was with his family, with the family, and I was too drunk. My whole family was upset because I was drinking. And I just want to found a garbage can, and I want to get into that. I want to get in inside, and I say, that's who I am, a garbage. Because I can't stop drinking. One of my niece called the ambulance, and I was in the ambulance in Christmas in January, and I said, "That's it. I can't do it no more." I went to rehab, and I came back. I started going to groups. I went to this group, but someone was talking in the front, but some people was laughing in the middle of the room, and many people was really, they was laughing and playing around. So I said, that's not going to help me. I mean, I said, these people is going to get me crazy. I'm not too crazy yet. And then I had my first relapse. I went to this place, and I met Christian. He told me about Atlantic Group, and I came, and I just doing my job. I call my person every day, and I'm doing my steps. When I was seven days, that happened, the most bad thing in my life. Someone called me they told me that my mother passed away. It was so hard for me. I don't know what to do. I don't want to drink, because I know that it was so easy to take me. If I was still drinking, I could be dead. And I called my sponsor. I said, I can't drink. I don't want to drink. But he just, I'm just going to die too. He told me, no, you survive. You can cry. You can scream. But you had to be come to the meetings. He was just like pulling me, come to the meetings. The big book is waiting for you. And I was just like, I don't know if I can do it. But then I say, I had to be there. I had to do my meetings. I had to do my service. And sometimes people call me, and sometimes I don't know what to say. But I know that what I'm doing is right. I know that if I stay with you guys, I'm going to be all right, and I'm still going to be sober. because I know if I go back, if I still drinking, I'm gonna be there. Usually, what I used to do, I feel that when I was drinking, I feel that it was the king passing from the cars. It doesn't matter if the cars they were running. I was like, I don't care. It's because all the liquor made me feel like that I was like Superman. I don't know. I just want to do whatever I want. And I prefer to be here. I prefer do my job and do everything I'm supposed to say. I call people. And I always try to be the best I can. Thank you so much. Thank you for your support.
Our main speaker tonight is Thea.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks. Hi, my name is Thea. I'm an alcoholic. Hello. Oh, it's so great to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's so great to see all your beautiful, shining faces and that you all made it here, despite the transit strike, like Lucy said, you know. If it were a drink, we would cross river and dale, mountain and, you know, trek through anything. In fact, I have a very powerful and wonderful memory of being here with a group a little bit smaller than this, but a group on 9/11. And this was the first place I wanted to come. It was a Tuesday, and I wanted to be here because I felt like this was a place where I would be safe and where I would kind of get my grounding, would know what to do next. And that's kind of how it was from the very beginning. And I still come to these rooms to know what to do next. Hang on, I left my water. Thanks. So I'll start off with my vital statistics, I guess. My sobriety date is August 31st, 1984, and my sponsor is Jane, and I have five wonderful babies, sponsees. I'm working all the steps every day, especially in the month of December. I find the month of December is really challenging for me anyway, and I think maybe for a lot of alcoholics. And my home group is the Atlantic Group. Yeah. So, the month of December it's great to speak in this month because it really is a tough month for me. Of course, there are there's a lot of social interaction this month, a lot of parties, a lot of smiling and happiness and cheerfulness, enforced cheerfulness. The streets are very crowded. I work in Times Square. Kill me now. I feel like we should give like tutorials for tourists starting maybe in like mid-October about what a sidewalk is. Notice the second syllable, side, walk, walk. So there, I just feel like I'm constantly standing between people who are standing four across, holding hands, and looking up. I'm always behind them in a hurry. So I don't own a car, but this is my version of road rage, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, it's most acute in the month of December, when I'm supposed to be most tolerant and charitable. And I just feel like sometimes it's the most, the most taxing. But so I have these steps, which work now, as in all the months, but very, very helpful. So a lot of why December is hard for me. You know, I talked about the togetherness and parties and social interaction, and of course drinking. A lot of sugar and booze is in this month, which is, you know, my two favorite food groups. At one point. But also, I think the thing that makes it the toughest for me and always did is the thinking part. It's really not the drinking. It's all my ideas about what this month and what these holidays, whatever you celebrate, is supposed to look like. and what I'm supposed to be like and what I'm supposed to look like and how it's supposed to feel and all this stuff, you know, all this stuff. And that is really hard to get through, is all that stuff. So I'm very always very happy when January 2nd rolls around. That's like my favorite day, you know, in some ways, because it's the point farthest on the calendar. Anyway, that feeling of not belonging, of being on the outside looking in, that both of our previous speakers alluded to, is something that I definitely identified with right from the get-go, one of my earliest memories. And I often think of rooms of alcoholics and of Alcoholics Anonymous as a pack of lone wolves. It's a paradox, but I really feel like that's one thing that we all share in common, is that sense of being kind of a lone wolf, being a renegade, an outsider looking in. I come from a lovely family, absolutely lovely family. No alcoholism in my family. I'd never been exposed to alcoholism. My parents both drank growing up. You know, they would have a cocktail when my dad would come home from work. My parents are the kind of people that, you know, would have that cocktail and then get busy doing something and forget where they put it down. That never happened to me. I never, ever had that experience where I forgot where I put a drink or where I left one that was half finished, you know. It just never happened to me, never, from the very first one. I drank it to the bottom. I finished it always. So I had no idea what even alcoholism was. But I knew very early on that I was different. I felt other. I felt a little itchy, a little uncomfortable in my skin, and I wanted to get out. I didn't know where, but I just knew it was not here, not now, not me, not with you. This was the wrong place. These were the wrong people. It was the wrong color. It was too big, a little bit too short, a little bit to the left. It was just a little bit, you know, I just wanted it to be a little bit different, and I needed to get out. Over the course of my life, that out has taken a lot of different forms, geographics, certainly alcohol, dry goods, as people say, a lot of different means of getting out. But that was certainly something that I was always looking for. By the time I had my first drink, which I guess I was about 13 or 14, I really needed it. I was really uncomfortable. And from the very first drink, the very first night that I drank, I drank to blackout. I just never understood any other way to drink. That was always the way I drank. The idea was to get out. The idea was to anesthetize, to be unconscious. I didn't want to socialize. That was why I drank. I didn't want to mingle. I was a drinker alone. I didn't really drink in bars. I didn't really drink with other people. Partly I didn't want to share, and partly that I didn't trust you. And I knew I was going to be drinking to unconsciousness. So I didn't trust you to be around you after I got to that point. And I also wasn't sure what I would do. That was one thing that was pretty consistent, is I didn't always drink every day, but I could never be sure what would happen after that first drink. I could say that I'm only going to have one, but I could never really be sure. And that, when alcohol, the definition of alcoholism was put to me that way, it was pretty hard to argue with, because that was definitely true. So anyway, my family, delightful people, calm, not very dramatic. Those poor people, I think they just wonder where the heck I ever came from. But just to give you one small example of the kind of chaos, the kind of hurricane, you know, they talk about us sweeping through lives like a hurricane, the kind of chaos that I wrought upon these poor people and their perfectly sane and lovely reaction to it. One time I was desperate to get to, I grew up in Connecticut, a party where there was going to be a lot of stuff, drinking, all kinds of things in the city. So it was about 11 o'clock. And as we know, you know, you have to drink to get to the point where you can go out to a party to drink. See, this is what I love about, you are my tribe. Everybody nods. Yeah, I mean, My family, God bless them, would just not understand that. But obviously, you have to drink to get to the party where you can drink. So I had. It took me till 11 o'clock. I had incredible tolerance right from the get-go. So it took me till 11 o'clock to kind of get to that state where I was like, okay, I'm ready to go. So 11 o'clock, I'm ready to go, and I get in the car to drive to the train station, and in the driveway there are three cars parked. It's Saturday night. There are three cars parked in the driveway. My parents are at a party themselves. And I get in the car, step on the gas, and I back up into one of the cars. So now I've rear-ended the car that I'm in with the car behind me. That was bad. I didn't like that sound. So I put it in drive and then into the other car. So now I've wrecked three cars without leaving the driveway. This is efficiency, three cars without leaving the driveway. So I thought, well, what am I going to do now? I really have to get to this party. So, but I don't want my, you know, my folks are going to come home and they're going to see this. So I know I'm going to be responsible. I'm going to call them. So I called the party. They'd left the number. I called them and tracked them down. My dad got on the phone. And I said, I just want you to know that I wrecked three cars and I'm going out and I may not be home tonight. So, and he said, you wrecked three. He said, where are you? And I said, I'm standing in the kitchen. He said, where are the cars? I said, they're in the driveway. And so he kind of got the picture, and he said, well, are you okay? His first thought, are you okay? Are you hurt? And I said, no, I'm fine. I said, it's kind of dark. I don't know how the cars are. And he said, you know, it's Saturday night, and there's not a lot we can do about it right now. Everything's closed. So he said, why don't we talk about it in the morning? Why don't you go where you have to go, and we'll talk about it tomorrow. No screaming, no, you know, this is the family I came from. And I had no exposure to alcoholism or drama. As I said, I was a loner from high school. I started taking independent studies. It's kind of a miracle. This is, in a lot of ways, I think December is like a month of a lot of different religions celebrate miracles of some version this month. And it's amazing for me to be standing in a room full of this many people. I didn't even want to go to class. I took independent studies straight through high school. I was in an alternative high school, so I wouldn't have to sit in a room with this many people. It just gave me hives. You know, I just didn't want to interact, any kind of social interaction. Didn't want to do it. I wanted to live all up in here. It was where I was comfortable. And I think in some ways, fantasy was like my first, you know, drug of choice. Just any means of getting out. So then I went to a college that allowed me to take all independent studies. And I was doing a lot of just solo living in my own head. I did geographics right up in here. And I don't know how I'm a writer. So a lot of times I rationalize that that drinking was a way of kind of opening up my imagination, you know? I was so inhibited, you know? So, yeah, right. So I would drink to kind of loosen up my imagination and my creativity. Except the thing is, you know, I would never get anywhere because, as I said, I was a blackout drinker. So I would drink to, you know, oblivion. And then what ideas I had, I couldn't remember anyway if I did have any. I once asked an old boyfriend, I couldn't remember, you know, after I came to AA, I started to hear all kinds of stories about happy drunks and sad drunks, and I didn't have a lot of memories about my drinking and what kind of person I was. And so I asked him, was I a happy drunk or a sad drunk? And he said, you were a horizontal drunk. And that pretty much describes it. So what happened for me was that I really got to be increasingly uncomfortable. After college, I started pulling some geographics. I thought I didn't have a problem with change because I went through one period of 15 months where I never lived in one place for longer than 12 months. I mean, I went for more 15 years where I never lived in one place for longer than 12 months. I never lived in one apartment for longer than 12 months. So I felt like, oh, I'm very comfortable with change, you know, no problem. but, you know, try to get me to change my modality, which is cut and run, right? That was really my what I did. And so I kind of did that hurricane act all over. I started running out of geography to do geographics with. New York, California, Texas, Iowa, New York twice, upstate New York, Connecticut. I moved a lot of different places. I got to a point where I really wasn't sure what the truth was. I was working in this little job. My life had now shrunk down to where I'd crashed and burned in my parents' house. I had this goofy little job, my parents' house, and the liquor store, and that was basically the map of my travels now. It was so small. The bigger my ideas got, the bigger my fantasies got, the smaller my life shrank down. And the bigger my grandiosity, you know, my dreams of becoming, you know, I'd practice my acceptance speeches for all of these great things that I was going to do and interactions I was going to have. But really, I was not even getting farther than the liquor store and work and home. But I couldn't really tell what reality was. I was working with this woman. She was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she gave me that, you know, idea, try going for... you know, try doing some controlled drinking. Try having two drinks a night. Yee. So I did try, and I couldn't do it. And, you know, I'm so willful. I've always been so willful, and I was amazed that I couldn't do this. And, you know, I've always been faithful in that way, that I always had faith that I could figure it out, that I could work it out, that I could make it work, that tomorrow would be different. You know, that I could figure out some way to manage it. And in some ways, I think I'd been a spiritual seeker. I love the definition of alcohol as being a spiritual thirst. So I had tried through all this seeking. A lot of it was many different religions and ashrams and all different kinds of ways of solving my problem. I was going to figure it out. I was going to get on top of this and manage it. And I was horrified to find out that I couldn't do this controlled drinking. Then I started to do things where I would try to manage the drinking by doing other substances. So I was kind of like, sure, I haven't had a drink in 2 days, but I was doing something else to manage it. And that was really, you know, the fact is, I couldn't get a day where I just had no substances in me at all. And that was heartbreaking when I finally came down to realize that. So I wandered into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and like a lot of us, you know, no exposure to alcoholism, no understanding of what this disease was, and yet walk into a room full of strangers and feel kind of interested or sense something here that's good and that's trustworthy and that's safe. And I didn't even know what I really came in here for, but I liked the stories. One of the things, you know, I'd run out of ideas, a writer with no ideas, and here these people were telling these fantastic stories. I thought, gosh, if I can just sit here and transcribe these, I'm golden, you know, this is great. So I came here for fiction, found the truth. So much of what I thought I was here for. I'll tell you something, I certainly did not come here to not drink for 21 years. That was not my motivation. So much of what I've thought I wanted or what I planned, what my strategy was, has been kind of backwards and upside down. In some ways, I think faith and thinking are opposite. Like, I tried to really think my way into faith through all those different religions. I really tried to think, to figure it out, to get on top of it, to figure out a way to have a relationship with God. I knew that was important, but I didn't know how to get there, so I was trying flavor of the month, a lot of different ways. You know, if I only had the right, you know, orange robes, if I only had the right meditation pillow, if I only found the right church. I have my old sponsor, Cindy C., who is now the chair of the Pacific Group. And she told me this story a couple of days ago, that she, in her spiritual quest, she had took a course in this church where they kind of train people to take an office in the church, and it was a graded course. So you go through this course where you learn all about this stuff, and she said she got a B in God. You know, I was so grateful when I came in here and I saw people of all different walks of life, all different descriptions, all different ages, colors, shapes, sizes, orientations. And all of us are here as a tribe. Somehow, I don't even know what it is that joins us together. There's no grading here. There are these 12 incredible steps, but there's no time limit. If you haven't finished a certain step by a certain, you know, month, you're out. I wanted some reason to leave. You know, when I came in, I listened to these stories. I stood in the back. I came late, left early. I wasn't sure I belonged, but I kept coming back. I was so curious about you all. I was so curious about how you all were here. And I didn't think that I could ever belong to a group like this. But I caught alcoholism. Someone said, why don't you try 90 meetings in 90 days? And I said, well, I would like to try that. If I'm an alcoholic, I certainly will do that. And right now what I'm trying to do is figure out if I'm an alcoholic or not. And when I figure it out, and if I say yes, then I'll do that. And she said, why don't you try doing 90 meetings in 90 days, and then on the 91st day, decide if you're an alcoholic. Well, that was really opposite. That's acting your way into a new way of thinking. And that has been a great gift that I've learned how to do. I've learned how to take actions that I don't understand or agree with right from that get-go and right from the point when someone said, get a sponsor. My whole goal had been autonomy. That's what I wanted. I wanted to be autonomous. The idea of getting a sponsor, that was dependence. And this idea of surrender, I mean, this whole thing that I'm trying to do is get a control. I want to get a grip. I want to figure it out. And these people are talking about surrender. I'm saying affirmation. I can do it. I can do it. And the first step is, I can't do it. So much of it did not make sense to me. It was so upside down and backwards. And yet, somehow, it works. And, you know, that's what this program has going for it, is that it works. It works as nothing else does. And it worked right from the get-go. What I knew how to do at the beginning was don't drink and come to meetings. I think that I did that for like the first 5 years. I was so confused in my brain. Everything was so confusing to me. I had so much fiction in there that I couldn't even figure out, you know, basic stuff. So I would don't drink and go to meetings. That's what I'd do. I'd just show up at meetings. And when there wasn't a meeting, I would go to the answering service. I just wanted to be around you. And I wasn't sure if I had alcoholism, but I did do 90 meetings in 90 days, and I'm so thrilled that there's someone here who has 90 meetings. I never thought that could happen to me. And I did. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. I just did it a day at a time. On the 91st day, that same woman asked me if I had decided if I was an alcoholic. And I really was still in my head, maybe yes, maybe no, depending on how I feel. Sometimes I feel yes, sometimes I'm in a different mood. I was still doing that back and forth thing. And she said, well, is your life better than it was 91 days ago? She had me there. There was no question. It was so much better. So what I thought was that whatever was wrong with me, my strange and unusual disease, which was very unique and different, was so parallel and undiscovered yet to be discovered, because I was the only one, of course, but that it was so parallel to alcoholism that somehow the treatment for alcoholism applied to whatever it was, the as yet to be named Theaism, that was afflicting me. And gradually, I got to the point where I could stand up and say, my name is Thea, I'm an alcoholic. And that's when the solution really began for me. I caught alcoholism in these rooms. And that was the best news. It was the thing that I fought the hardest, but it was the best news. Because once I knew that I had alcoholism, I knew what to do about it. I knew what would help me. And there were people who had paved the path, who could tell me what to do and to help me through it a day at a time. And that's what I've been doing. And that's how I get through 21 Decembers. It's a really incredible program. So much of it I understand even less about now than I did when I first came in. And that's a great comfort to me. For someone who came in really, I came in here to figure it out, as I said. I didn't come in here to quit drinking. I certainly didn't come in here to surrender. I came in here to figure it out and to manage, get a grip on my life, to get a control of things, to manage things. And what I found is a great peace and a great comfort in not knowing. In not knowing. It's a great place to be. I just follow these steps. I'm powerless. That's the good news. Because then I need a higher power, which is wonderful. I've come to believe that my higher power can restore me to sanity. I don't even know what sanity is anymore, and I don't care. But I figure, you know, my higher power knows, so that's good. I don't even think about what sanity is. Because oftentimes, whatever I think is not what shows up. I have an idea of how things are going to look, and I say, okay, it's going to be blue, and it's going to be shaped like this. And then I'm looking around for something that's blue and shaped like that. I'm keeping my eyes open, looking for something that's blue, that's shaped like that. And I miss it when it shows up and it's yellow and shaped like something else. And that's always how my sobriety has been. That the things that I have most given me what I wanted have not been what I thought would give me what I wanted. It's not been what I expected. It's not been what I wanted. So I have to let go and surrender of all of my ideas. One of my most favorite prayers is, God, let me set aside everything I think I know about you, me, the steps in AA, that I may have an open mind and a new experience of you, me, the steps in AA. Grant me the power to see the truth. So I came into these rooms. I worked the steps. I got a sponsor. I think if you're new, I would say, get a sponsor immediately. Don't drink and go to meetings. Get a sponsor immediately. Tonight. Tonight can be the night you get a sponsor. And it doesn't even matter who it is. Just ask someone. Just get it done. Don't shop. Just get it done. It's a great thing. The important part is your willingness. When the first time I stood at this podium, Peggy Byrne gave me a beautiful pin. It was such an act of kindness. I just moved to New York. As a little gold pin that said, willingness is the key. I still have it, and it really is the key. I don't have to know anymore. I don't have to figure it out. I just have to be willing, and in most cases, it's willing not to know and willing to take direction, even when it's contrary to what I think I want. So tonight, for example, I had tickets to the Royal Court British production of Measure for Measure. And I'm a playwright. I adore Shakespeare. I've been looking forward to this show for months, months and months and months. But I never say no to an AA request. That's one of the things that I learned how to do, is never say no to an AA request. Never. I never say no to a sponsee. I never say no to any AA request. And I'm thrilled to be here tonight. And I know, even though that was tough to say, you know, I took a deep breath before I said it, but I know that if I'd been in that show right now, what I would be doing is I'd be thinking about you. I would. I would be thinking, just like I questioned whether I was an alcoholic or not, I'd be sitting in the dark, all those wonderful words on the stage saying, gosh, maybe I should have said yes. That's the first time I didn't. I wouldn't hear a word. So it's so easy. And I called my sponsor and I said, can there ever be exceptions to this? And she said, well, what did you say? And I said yes. And she said, isn't that certainty comforting? It is. I know what I'm going to say to an AA request, and that really is comforting. It really is great to be with you all. I can't think of any other place that I'd rather be, especially this month, especially in this month of miracles. My tradition is to celebrate Christmas, and so many Christmases I got down on my knees and took the pledge to God that this year I would not drink. So many of them. And couldn't keep it. So many times pouring red wine down my throat saying, tomorrow will be the day. I was always a person of great faith. I always believed tomorrow, you know. And it wasn't until I finally said, no, I can't, that it started to work. So confusing. I'll just tell this one little story that really is an example of how backwards and upside down it seems. It all came together for me one time when I was sitting in this meeting, and I was, you all have to use your imaginations here. I was sitting in a meeting, the door was behind me, and in front of me on this wall was a giant mirror. So I could look in that mirror and see the door behind me. And I suddenly had this realization that that's how my alcoholism is. This is the disease of perception. That all my life, I had been walking toward that door that I could see right in front of me, framed in the mirror perfectly, right there, right in front of me, and could never make it out. Never make it out of the door. Never make it out into the world I could see right beyond the door, and I could never get out of the room. And it was because, and then I come into this room, and you people tell me, go that way. Well, how could that be the right direction? I could see the door right in front of me. And that's how it's been for all these years. Still, the direction I get doesn't make sense to me. And I have great peace in being able to take it anyway. It works. It really does. And I'm so grateful, finally, that I don't have Theaism, that I have alcoholism. I'm very grateful, and I hope that every one of you can catch this wonderful disease too, because it draws us together, this pack of lone wolves, and it's a really amazing ride. That's all I can say. It's just an incredible ride. Get a sponsor, don't drink, come to meetings, and celebrate with me on January 2nd when we get through this season. Thank you very much.